Tea, oh, the sweet, tasty tea. Let's have some tea at the tea party that starts at 3.
Well, hello there.
Welcome to He Saw, She Saw.
I am Corey.
And I am Keith.
And we love movies.
Just not the same ones.
So every episode, we make the other watch a movie that we love.
But the other would never watch unless we were doing a podcast together.
And then we talk about it. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We are in that space between Christmas and New Year's where you don't know what day it is.
Time does not exist.
Time is a construct.
Showers do not exist.
Oh, well, showers always exist. I got sick again. Whoop, whoop. All I did was go to Trader Joe's and I came home with a cold. Finally got rid of the Christmas cookies. Don't tell anybody throughout the last three.
Oh.
What?
Oh, just because I'm allergic to them doesn't mean I didn't want to eat them.
Oh my God, you ate all of them.
They were really good.
I think I had a bite of one.
They were good stuff. So every year we do an afternoon of Christmas cookie decorating. I got pretty creative this year.
You did, because we had some cookies that didn't quite turn out.
Oh my gosh, so many cookies didn't turn out this year. So many blobs.
I get so angry. Like, I did all this extra stuff to make sure that they would hold their shape. And they're always just big, stupid puffs of blob. And
the mustache always comes out.
The mustache does always come out.
But the unicorn, oh no.
Oh no, because it's got a really tiny horn and that always comes off. Well, you know what always comes out? It's the stingrays.
The stingrays, of course, they did. Pretty distinctive shape.
Yeah, we'll post some pictures of our stingrays. They had happy faces.
They did.
We have non-traditional Christmas cookie shape. So we've been having a holiday.
Well, this is the last day of 2023. Mm-hmm. How has this year been for you?
It was good. We got to go on a trip. That was awesome. So when Keith was a wee bairn, I think we've shared this, he lived in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
You lived in Nina, Ireland. Mm-hmm. And his mother has been talking about going back ever since I've met her.
It was a very cool trip. We've been talking about going there for decades. And so this was the year that we went as a family. So my mom and dad and Corey and I and our daughter, we all got to go. Even found our old house.
That you used to live in.
It was a half step up from a country village when we lived there. So it's still a very...
It's so tiny.
It's still a very tiny...
They do, however, it was the site of the only actual castle that we got to see. Because we were going to go to Blarney Castle, but we had already gone to the Cliffs of Moher. And that was a full-on day trip.
Yeah.
And we were like, ugh. So we didn't go to Blarney Castle, but we did go to Nina Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Malahide Castle, which is not really a castle.
Oh, complete ripoff. I'll say it. They have a very good ferry trail.
It was a really good ferry trail. The top ferry trail.
Yeah, we got like a Viking ship.
That's right. We did the Viking tour in Dublin.
Which you gotta go to.
Well, you have to have Keith the Viking. Exactly. Not you, Keith. No. Although I feel like you'd probably do a good job too, but Keith the Viking.
I felt a kinship spirit with him. I felt like
we're both named Keith. Everybody on the street, and
especially priests.
A seagull straight up slapped me in the face. We were at St. Stephen's Green in Dublin, mm-hmm, and enjoying the view, and some seagulls flew by and literally slapped me in the face with his wing because he, mm-hmm, got too close.
Oh my God.
And everybody was like, oh my God. Anyway, we went to Dublin and we went to Nina and then we did a couple days in London and, mm-hmm, we got to see Matilda in the West End with all of the elementary schools. We were like standing in line, we're like ready to go in, and there was this humongous group of kids in uniform. And I was like, oh, I wonder which show they're going to go to. And you turned to me and you were like, really?
Well, I mean, I think I pointed to the poster, which is of a girl in a school uniform.
It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to see that one.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I'm sure they were going to go see Kinky Boots or whatever. I'm sure that was the... I'm sure that's what they were going for. But
it was an awesome show. It was amazing. We had really terrible seats, but it was just an amazing show. Mm-hmm. It was quite enjoyable. Your dad kind of made himself the trip executive assistant, which is perfect for this movie that we're doing, because, mm-hmm, there's a guy in the movie that, like, the whole time we were on the trip, I just kept, like, your dad was reminding me of him.
What is this movie we're going to watch that you're going to force me to watch against my will?
Darjeeling Limited. And it has Adrian Brody, Jason Schwartzman, and Owen Wilson, who, mm-hmm, I know you enjoy. And I think you like Wes Anderson movies.
I'm very strategic with Wes Anderson movies.
Oh,
so
I didn't know this.
there have been some movies I have steered clear from, including this one, the Darjeeling Limited, which is your movie.
It's a tea. Just like Ceylon is a tea.
Mm-hmm.
Jasmine is a tea. And then you've got
And Mr. T with the gold chains. Okay. And I think you're going to like the movie I've got for you. It's got three of your favorites, two especially. Mm-hmm. It's got Mark Ruffalo.
I love him.
And Adrian Brody. And I think you like Rachel Weisz, right?
I love Rachel Weisz.
Yeah. So a movie called The Brothers Bloom, which I don't think I've really never heard anybody talk about before.
I've never heard of it.
I thought it was a good movie. So I saw it once. I liked it a lot. It was years ago. I may or may not have been half asleep through it, but I remember liking it. So, hey, let's give this a whirl.
When are you not half asleep?
That's a good question. So here we go. The Brothers Bloom and the Darjeeling Tea Limited.
Close.
So you ready to talk about the Darjeeling Limited?
Darjeeling.
See, now what people don't understand is I should be able to do this, but I think partially it's just a subconscious mental block on how you intentionally always mispronounce things that you know I like.
I do not.
Okay, steampunk.
Okay, maybe I do.
Maybe you do.
What did I say last night? You were like, oh, I think I'm going to go get something. And I was like, oh, you're going to get something from Steam Bowl?
Yeah, from Fresh Bowl.
From Fresh Bowl? What's it called?
The Flame Broiler. It works. The funny thing is that I basically always no-sell it, too. I always just like, okay, what does she mean? Okay, got it. Can't get upset. That just encourages it. So does this movie hold up for you, Corey?
I love this movie. I love Wes Anderson. I love how weird and quirky it is. I feel like if I was a filmmaker, this is the type of movie I would make where it's a very specific world and he just spends way too much time on little tiny details. I love the relationship between the brothers. Adrian Brody is so clearly the middle child.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like all Wes Anderson movies are about people who are insanely rich and have nothing else to do but have depression.
You summed it up. You never have to see a Wes Anderson movie now. So.
No, you should see all of them. So do you have a pitch for this movie?
Of course. When three rich, eccentric brothers lose their father unexpectedly, they travel to India to mourn and see if they can make their family work on the Darjeeling Limited. So, this movie starts strong. Bill Murray is in a hurry to get to a train station in India. The taxi weaves in and out of traffic. Bill Murray shows up just as the train is leaving, bursts to the front of the line, says, that's my train. And then he's running as fast as he can, and suddenly he's overtaken by Peter Whitman, played by Adrian Brody, who also is chasing after the same train. It is a nice little role. It is just a cameo, but one of the themes of the movie as we go through is everyone has stuff going on and everyone is struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was one way that theme is kind of brought out is in this opening scene. Peter, Adrian Brody, pulls himself onto the caboose, puts on his father's very distinctive sunglasses, and makes his way through the train, through all the poor people places, to get to, of course, his privileged rail car that he's staying in. And when he walks in, his brother Jack is asleep, being played by Jason Schwartzman. Peter wakes him up, and Jack asks if he's seen Francis, who comes in, and it is Owen Wilson, who is incredibly beat up, has bandages all over the place. So we also pretty quickly meet the train's main no-nonsense steward, played by a very stern Boris Aluwalia. And a pretty stewardess who is in some sort of relationship with them, played by Amara Karan in her film debut. If it wasn't clear already, all three brothers are in just full-on rich white privilege mode, barely giving a wisp at the rules and just kind of doing whatever. We soon learn the dynamics of the brothers. Francis is a very bossy older brother who constantly is ordering his brothers under the guise of like, hey, you want to do this right? Constantly wants to make agreements. Let's make an agreement. And then says what he wants to have happen and say, okay, do we have an agreement?
Everybody vote.
Vote for what I told you to vote for. Peter is the rebellious middle child who will kind of passively, aggressively stand up against Francis every once in a while. And Jack is the baby who just silently goes on with whatever's happening and just kind of is fine just being in the background.
Except Francis is always dragging him under the bus. Jack agrees with
me. Jack agrees with me, yeah. They all seem pretty equally repulsed and attracted to each other as brothers. There's a weird push-pull dynamic between them all. In addition to being really beat up from a motorcycle crash, Francis is preoccupied with Peter stealing things, especially things that may have belonged to their late father. Peter's wife, Alice, is 7 months pregnant, so of course he's nowhere around. He's in friggin' India instead of by her side as he should be. And Jack can't get his horrible ex-girlfriend off his mind. He's always just kind of one step away from ditching the brothers to go somewhere else. They also do the thing I hate, which is they share a secret with one brother and then say not to tell someone else.
Mm-hmm. But then they immediately tell.
Yeah. Among all this exposition, we also find out that the brothers haven't seen each other in about a year or like over a year since their father's sudden death and they were all at the funeral. But also, weirdly, none of them have been in contact with their mother, who wasn't at the funeral. So Francis, in the midst of all this, had this big idea that they're going to meet in India and go on this train ride and go on this spiritual journey together. And don't worry, he's already got an assistant, Brandon.
Always mess up Brandon and Brandon.
Yes. It's the same name.
No, Keith and Kaif are not.
Now you're just making words up. So Brendan would never be seen.
AKA your dad.
He's facilitating everything. And he's
got a laminating machine.
He's got a laminating machine and will be putting a laminated itinerary under their doors like every morning.
Every morning.
Which is funny because for the rest of the movie, they never get the itinerary in the morning. So why is my dad Brendan?
Whenever we wanted to do anything, your dad would pull out the 3-ring binder with the plastic sleeved itinerary and accoutrement.
Yep. My dad is a little organized.
The binder went with us everywhere.
Yeah, the binder was almost always with us at all times. This trip, my mom had been wanting to go on for decades. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't perfect. There was a couple of oopses and screw ups, but.
Like you do.
Yeah, but that's just life. It was a wonderful trip. But
however, our daughter got to look like a little business lady in her little business cubby on the airplane. And then we had to sit her down and tell her, look, this is never happening again.
Yeah.
So don't get used to it.
So my parents are getting a little older.
They needed the foot room.
Yeah. And we don't do these trips like, you know, every few decades. So it's like, let's save up. And, you know, if we're going to do this big trip, Yeah. Actually, getting to be on business class, it got me angry. It wasn't totally like awesome perfect.
Right.
But it was so much better.
100 times better.
100 times better than regular.
And then we even got to go into the lounges.
Mm-hmm.
And the lounges were like, whatever you want to eat or drink. And so, of course, I stuffed like 4 sandwiches in my bag.
Yeah. That's so much more expensive. Can we just split the difference? And have business class or first class just a slightly less nice and let everybody have it. Like, that's how that should be. But anyway, it was a fun trip. And Brendan is one of the unsung heroes.
I love Brendan
and Alice. So so even amongst of all this like dysfunction between the brothers, Jack is able to catch the eye of the pretty stewardess, Rita. And without knowing that she's somehow connected with the steward, asks if she wants to join him for a cigarette. Which is evidently code for let's have sex in the bathroom. So not in the morning, but when itineraries are passed under the door, Peter, who's already tired of Francis's crap, immediately opens it up so everybody gets to meet Brendan.
Who was supposed to be
an invisible servant. Francis takes Brendan to the hall, asks if she knows they're coming, and Brendan said, well, he left a message. Not good enough for Francis, who gets even more overbearing than normal, and insists that Brendan has to do better, call every 10 minutes, make sure it happens. So the next morning, we finally have our first stop, and it's at a temple city. And again, we are subjected to even more white pretentious foolishness. Peter is wearing a belt that he's not supposed to be wearing.
It's Dad's belt.
Peter, but also buys an incredibly poisonous and dangerous snake.
And brings it on the train.
Francis gets one of his $3,000 loafers stolen by a shoeshine kid, like immediately. And Jack is barefoot.
Very Beatles.
Every time he's walking anywhere, I'm just like going, ow, ow, ow. So we're back on the train, and the boys are still angry at each other and getting in stupid arguments. And in the midst of this, Peter realizes the snake is no longer in the box. And so they're all three freaking out, racing into the hallway, and the steward is like, what is going on? And I think Francis is the one who says, we think there might be a poisonous snake on the train. The guy immediately goes, gets a spatula. He races in, comes immediately out with a snake, and they put it in a pod, and he just like lays into the brothers, as he should have. Because again, they have put the whole train in danger. Mm-hmm. In addition to all the other rules they've been breaking, they are confined to their cabin for the rest of the trip. We go on, I don't remember exactly how long, I kept blacking out during this movie, and the train comes to a sudden stop at some point in the middle of the desert, and we find out the train is lost. So
how can it be lost?
It's on a track. So they think maybe they might have switched over to the wrong track or something like that. And so Brendan, who of course is in charge of everything, says they haven't located us yet, which Francis takes as a sign and grabs 3 peacock feathers for a ritual and leads the brothers to the top of the hill. And there Francis confesses the real reason he called them together was to see their mom. He had a PI track down where she was, and she's at a Christian convent at the foot of the Himalayas. And of course, Jack and especially Peter are really kind of upset by this. But the train whistle blows, and so they're about to move, so they have to race down the hill to get back onto the train. Mm. And then, of course, the brothers just keep arguing, which is a good one half to two-thirds of this movie.
I mean, they're siblings.
So they've been sniping at each other and being weird and passively aggressive and not passively aggressive towards each other this whole time. Finally, Peter had enough and said, hey, here's your belt. And he throws the belt in Francis's already beat up face, and it smacks him right in the head. And they start fighting and rolling around, and Jack is like, stop it, guys. He went and got pepper spray. He sprays the pepper spray. They chase after him. And so as he's racing away from his brothers, he runs flat into the dining car door and shatters the window. The steward has had enough of this. And so at the next stop that night, the brothers and all of their luggage, which I guess we forgot to mention, but they wear the same outfits for the entire movie, but have like a good 12 pieces of huge luggage. Now, Brendan at first is going to go with them and says, hey, okay, so I figured out a hotel and this is what we need to do. And he's explained the backup plan. And then Francis is just insulting and demeaning and demanding to Brendan. So Brendan he nods and then just steps back on the train without a future word. And Peter says, oh yeah, he's quitting. So in the midst of this, Jack is having an interesting conversation with Rita. So Rita, the stewardess, is in the train still. And she just asks, like, what's wrong with you? And he says, well, let me think about it and I'll tell you next time I see you. And then he thanks Rita for using him. Then the train heads off without the brothers. The brothers just wander in the desert for some reason. And in the midst of that, Francis kind of unfolds a telegram, which Brendan evidently had given him earlier from their mom, who says that, oh yeah, by the way, I'm a nun. I am way too busy helping these people. And there's a hungry tiger, so don't come. Maybe try in the spring. Frustrated, the brothers decide to head to the airport and go their separate ways. So the next day, while pushing all 12 bags of luggage, the brothers going by a river. The river isn't like monstrous, but it's got a strong current. These boys have like this makeshift raft and they're trying to get across with like these goods. The boys kind of slip as they're trying to make their way using this rope across the river. And the 3 brothers immediately jump into action. They're able to save the 2 boys, but Peter is trying to free the last boy, but he's caught in the raft. And then what happens is the current gets immediately too bad and he's trying to get him out, and then the raft flips. The river takes them down a bit. By the time Francis and Jack can catch up to him, they just see Peter with like this big blood gash on his head and this lifeless body of the kid. And Peter is just distraught because he was like, I didn't save mine. The brothers walk with the 2 surviving boys and carrying the lifeless body of the child. And the father's distraught when he sees them, but it becomes very clear that the village understands what happened. You know, they take in the brothers and they start patches Peter up, and Peter, you know, gets to hold a baby for a little bit because, you know, your wife is pregnant half a world away.
It's pretty funny because they just hand him the baby and he's like, they're like, no, you're fine. Just take the baby.
Yeah, which is what they actually do in hospitals when we had our baby delivered.
You mean when they cut me open and pulled her out?
Yeah, the nurse basically handed me the baby in a way where I had to catch the baby. It just seemed so clear to me that she was like, you're holding this baby. You got it.
Meanwhile, I'm wondering if I'm ever going to feel the bottom half of my body again.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, the town basically adopts them for the night. And the brothers in the morning go to the bus stop, and the kid flags down the bus. And the 3 brothers get on a very crowded bus, and they manage to get all 12 bags on top of the bus. And then the little boy comes back and they're invited to the funeral. At the funeral, we get a flashback of their father's funeral from the year before. So they're in a limo with Peter's wife, Alice, and they're late to the funeral. But then Peter suddenly has to pick up the dad's Porsche at the shop. I don't know why all 3 brothers jump out, but all 3 brothers jump out.
Because they're brothers.
And Alice
I just say that I feel like Alice not only married Peter, but also inherited Jack and Princess.
Oh, yeah.
And is so long-suffering.
I hope she knew they were a package deal. So they all need a mother. So they have this, there's no other way to put this but a Wes Anderson scene of comedy, yet sadness of the brothers. Like, Peter tries to start the car. The car's not starting because it's missing a part. So Alice calls and is like, hey, you guys got to get here because there's another funeral right after ours. And oh, by the way, your mother's not coming. She refused to get on the plane. Francis keeps that to himself. And after some hijinks, Francis, fortunately with Alice, was like, hey, you got to send the car back because this isn't going to work out. We're back to the present. And the brothers are somber and respectful during the funeral. And either that afternoon or the next day, the brothers are waiting at the bus stop again. The kid flags down the bus again. But as they're waiting for the bus, three people show up. And then like five people show up. And like 10 people show up. And by the time the bus is flagged down, there's like 50 people waiting. The 50 people, including the father, were there to like show respect. And so
to
they
see them off.
To see them out and to bow, basically.
I did not like this movie.
Basically to say thank you. So we finally get to the airport and the brothers are feeling good about themselves because I think for the first time in their lives, they did something right. But that's I digress.
They did something unselfish.
And they appear to be on the right track. And so we get an airport scene where they're kind of healing. They're still flawed, but they're healing, getting being a little better. And they're about to board the flight, so they're on the tarmac, and you can't hear a thing because all the planes are there. And they get to the base of the stairs, and suddenly all three brothers at the same time rip up their tickets because obviously they're going to go find their mom, whether she wants them to be there or not. We make it to the mom, who is, of course, Angelica Houston, because this is a Wes Anderson movie, and so certain people have to be in the movie.
Right.
She is both angry and overjoyed for them to be there. We quickly see that Francis's overbearingness comes directly from the mom.
Oh my God.
Who orders them around as much, if not more, than Francis was, and always is setting forth agreements for them. In the middle of this, we also learn, she asks like Francis, what's going on with all the wraps? And he's like, well, I drove my motorcycle into a mountain. So he basically just admits flat out that it wasn't an accident. It was a suicide attempt. But that gets no reaction from her or the rest of the family. So they have a somewhat family bonding day. And then she basically tucks them in at night. And as she is about to turn off the lights, Jack pipes up. They actually start to, perhaps for the first time in the history of the family, start to have like a needed productive conversation. Why wasn't she at the funeral? And, you know, why isn't she there for them? And she doesn't have any good answers. She just basically says that she's needed elsewhere. And it's very clear the brothers are like, well, we need you. Exasperated because she's being called out on her crap, she says that they could express themselves more fully if they didn't use their words. And she turns out the lights. And this is where I got super uncomfortable. The lights stay off and it's pitch black. And the movie is silent for an uncomfortable amount of time. And I'm like, what type of movie is this? Then they flick on the lights. The four of them sit in a circle and they're just looking at each other. And Angelica Houston's emoting. But it's really funny because as they go through the four, it's like, okay, we can see who the better actors are. And then we kind of have another dolly shot. And so we're kind of like transported to the train. And we see some Indian kids who might be Rita's kids. It's kind of impressionistic. So I couldn't tell. It's like, are these the kids from the village? Because it goes like basically linear.
Are you talking about from the one image train to shots of each person on the train? Like,
yeah.
Alice is in the, yeah. No, yeah. I think it's just a picture of what you said of like everybody has their own stuff that they're going through.
Yeah.
So it's like everybody's on a train car, theoretically, symbolically, because Alice is on the train too, but obviously she's not on the train.
Well, the most confusing shot out of any of it is the first shot, because we kind of have some kids on a bed. And then it moves to Rita smoking, which she's not supposed to, in the train car. Mm-hmm. So, but it's like, oh, is that her kids with the steward who walks through the room next? And he's like playing with the poisonous snake. And then
I think it's just everybody's compartmentalized what they're going through, like you said. So it's like the kids from the village of the kid who died.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's because the guy, the steward, said that he killed the snake, but then he's having a moment with the snake. And then Rita, she's still on the train.
So everyone's got like a moment. We, of course, go back to the four of them. And Angelica's had enough of the foolishness. And so she gets up and is like, okay, these are the arrangements for tomorrow.
Let's have breakfast.
Let's make another agreement. And then she'll see them in the morning. And she says, to be continued, and turns out the lights. So, of course, in the morning, she's not there. But the brothers really aren't surprised.
Nope.
They eat breakfast and finally do the peacock ritual, cementing their bond. They arrive late, of course, to their new train, which has already started to leave, and they can make it, but only if they let go of their dad's baggage.
Baggage!
Yeah, which I'm just like, oh my gosh. They make it on the train. So they're in their cabin, and Francis offers to give the brothers back their passports and hands them to him. But
because he's been keeping them the whole time.
Yeah, but Peter asks Francis to hold on to it for him, and Jack says it would be safer with him, and we are done with the movie. So, you know, so this is a Wes Anderson movie, so there are 5 million little intricate millennial hipster details.
You like Wes Anderson movies, though, right? Yeah. You don't?
When it comes to the script, really wasn't impressed. It's one of those movies that tries so hard to be deep, but it's trying to dive headfirst into the kiddies pool. It's about three spoiled brats with India as the backdrop. I really didn't understand the bluster that all the reviewers tried to say about how, like, oh, India is like a character in this movie. And I'm like, it's really not. It could have been anywhere that's like visually rich and underdeveloped. Like, it could have been anywhere in South Asia. So, and I realize this probably just makes me look horrible, but it's just like, I cannot stand the people in this movie. And like, just in general, I have never wanted to keep up with the Kardashians. I know I'm weird. I'm weird. I like traveling the world, but I like going off the beaten path, but I don't like to go just to exploit it. My favorite way to see the world is to go and do like a service trip. I love going to a country, working alongside people from that country who are already there, helping them, and then getting like 2 or 3 days at the end to like be a tourist. So this movie is just like all the Wes Anderson quirkiness is in full effect, but it's just pointless and garish. It doesn't like move the plot forward. I do like several Wes Anderson movies, but I think his shtick works a lot better when the main characters are kids. When it's Jason Schwartzman in Rushmore, or like the kids in Moonrise Kingdom, the kids are like damaged, but they don't know better. And they're just, their quirkiness is them trying to understand and work with the world around them. And usually that otherness kind of rubs up against the real world in some ways. And that there you see real growth and figuring out like how life should be. Movies like that, I can totally get behind and root for, but these guys are like in their 40s. Like, I guess we're supposed to believe they're in their 20s or 30s. I get they're in pain, but work it out, man. Like, just...
You have money, go see a therapist.
Yeah. So unfortunately, this movie's a big, too huge, white privilege thumbs down for me. And, but, you know, go see Rushmore and Moonrise Kingdom. Like, you know, those movies are fire. Those are good.
Keith, did this movie hold up for you?
Not all the way.
Oh, no.
So, there are many parts I liked about this movie. Mm-hmm. There's a couple issues with it, but I'm going to let you talk about it. And then if you don't bring it up, I'll bring it up later.
Oh, thank God.
But overall, I still think it's worth a watch.
Would you like to hear my pitch for this movie?
I would love to hear your pitch.
All right. Two con artist brothers plan to go their separate ways after they pull off one more con. But neither expected that one brother would fall in love with the mark and jeopardize the whole plan. Or did they?
The brothers bloom.
I have a theory.
Yeah, this is a movie that is rife of theory. They do not explain everything.
So we open with two boys. We have Steven, who's played by a gritty Mark Ruffalo. And we have Bloom, played by, and again, brooding Adrian Brody.
Mm-hmm. So much brooding.
He's brooding in the last one, too.
So much brooding.
He's a lot of brooding.
Especially in this one.
Also, I was confused. Is their last name Bloom? Is his name Bloom Bloom? Does he not even have his own first name?
Like I said, there are a lot of things in this movie that they don't quite explain, which also kind of took me aback at first, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, his name's Bloom Bloom, I guess. So the brothers are young. They're like 8 and 10. And they're bounced from one foster home after another. And they get kicked out for all kinds of reasons.
Quick thing of clarification, just so the audience understands. Mm-hmm. Mark Ruffalo and Adrian Brody do not play 8 and 10-year-olds. So when we flashback.
This is a flashback.
When we flashback, they are played by kids. Children. Yes.
One time they end up in what Stephen calls a one-hat town. One movie theater, one gas station, one school with one tight-knit group of happy, well-off children. And the brothers resent the town's children as they throw their change at the candy counter to buy Rocket Pops when all the brothers can afford are pixie sticks. So Stephen calls them the playground bourgeoisie as Bloom becomes enamored with a cute little girl in curls. And Stephen notices and he's inspired to come up with a flow chart with a 15-point plan on it. It basically cons the neighborhood children into giving them money to lead them to a cave of wonders. And Stephen makes sure that the cave is nice and muddy. And the children have a great time, but mess up their Sunday best. But all the parents catch wind of their little scheme, make them give the money back, and the brothers are given back to Children's Services for larceny. But not before they cut a deal with O. Henry, who is the town's one dry cleaner, who is the person who profits from all of the soiled clothing. And the brothers walk away with almost double the money that they would have earned off the kids. And this is where the brothers get their start as con artists.
I love the opening of the movie because it shows how smart the writer is. Because it's going one way and you're like, oh, okay, I see where this is going. And then there's an extra layer. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was a wonderful intro to the movie.
He's a real M. Night Shyamalan.
Take that out of your mouth right now. That is... My goodness.
That's basically what you just said.
I did not. Complexity. I like how...
Oh, that's funny. You're so mad.
I am upset. Morally outraged.
Well, calm down. So we cut to, I guess, modern day. It was really hard to tell what time period we're dealing with until we meet Penelope later in her Lambo, but I'll get to that. The brothers are in the middle of a con in the city of Berlin, and Stephen pushes some rich guy's buttons until the guy shoots Bloom with, unbeknownst to him, blanks. And Bloom fakes his own murder, and the shooter panics and runs away. And I think the building is also on fire. So then enter a woman whose con name we learn is Bang Bang, played by Orinko Kikuchi. Bloom sits up, spits out some blood, and says, "Tastes like tinfoil." Stephen's a little annoyed with everyone's laissez-faire attitude towards his brilliant scheme that he just pulled off. So they stop at a bar for the rap party, as they call it, where Stephen holds court with his friends and accomplices. So we learn that the brothers never work with the same crew twice, and we learn that Bang Bang is their fifth Beatle. She knows all the ins and outs and probably only speaks three words of English. We then see Bang Bang being hit on at the bar by a guy who's telling her... Do you remember what he said?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I'm pretty into anime.
Oh, wow. Yeah, just if you want to have no game and show that you're a racist, that's the way to go.
So she puts her lit cigarette in his mouth and walks away, and we see that it's actually a firecracker. And then off camera, there's a small explosion. And that's what you get for being basic.
I loved Bang Bang. I had forgotten that Bang Bang was in this movie, mm-hmm. and she was amazing.
I agree. I really liked Bang Bang a lot. Bloom is alone brooding with a pack of cards, and a woman barges in, fangirling all over, and she throws herself on the table in front of him over his card game, and she puckers up, expecting a kiss, and Bloom tells her that Stephen writes the cons like a Russian novelist, and that he wrote Bloom like a vulnerable antihero, and that's why she thinks she wants to kiss him right now, but it's a con. So he gets up and leaves her sprawled on the table in confusion. He needs air.
I don't think she wanted a kiss. I think she wanted more than that, but still.
It's his PG.
Yes.
So he heads outside for some air. They end up in a zoo.
The next day.
It's like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, didn't they miss the sunrise?
They missed the sunrise. That would have been nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then they end up in the zoo. And Stephen lets a camel loose while he's looking for the bathroom. And the boys argue on a bench about Bloom wanting out. But like actually really this time. Stephen tries to calm him down by offering him a flask that Bloom knocks out of his hand. And the loose camel picks it up and starts guzzling it. And Stephen says...
That's my favorite camel.
That's my new favorite camel. He then tries to change the subject by commenting on Bloom's blood-stained shirt, saying that real blood turns brown after a while, which will be important.
Clear foreshadowing.
There's a lot of beating you over the head with foreshadowing in this movie. So Bloom tries to get him to focus, and he says he hates him, and he hates that his life is a series of parts that Stephen has written for him. And he wants a real, unwritten life. So he's going to go away. Somewhere that Stephen and Bang Bang can't ever find him. So we're in Montenegro 3 months later.
Which, to be fair, if you're going anywhere on the planet and not to be found, Montenegro is a pretty good place to go.
It looked good to me. Stephen and Bang Bang have tracked Bloom down. Bloom and Stephen have a conversation over breakfast about how Bloom thinks he wants out, but he really actually doesn't. So Stephen gets up and he tells Bloom to follow him. And Bloom asks, "Where are we going?" And Stephen says, "New Jersey." And Bloom says, "Let me get my coat." Cut to New New Jersey. The next Mark lives all by herself in a ridiculous estate with loads of very liquid assets. The crew watches as Penelope Stamp, played by Rachel Weisz, speeds up the driveway and runs her Lambo into the cement tree planter. She gets out to check the damage, and Bloom stomps off. They don't do women. He's out anyway. He'll be in Montenegro, drinking. But Bang Bang hands Bloom a telescope, and he grabs it and starts watching Penelope dragging a huge harp onto the lawn, while a brand new Lambo is delivered on a flatbed truck.
Like you do.
Stephen says she's lived at home her entire life, she's bored, and she's a seed that needs sprouting. And Bloom thinks Stephen has something up his sleeve. Stephen just wants to give Bloom what he wants, and he swears that this is the last one, and he'll never make him do another con again. So the way that Bloom is going to meet Penelope is by riding a banana seed bike, which is a very big deal, down a hill and crashing into her car. Because there's nothing quite as effective as having your first conversation with a mark from the hospital bed that they put you in.
Sage advice.
There's a bit where Stephen and Bang Bang give him an Olympic score from the sidelines, while Penelope tries, after she hits him, tries to turn her car around, and then she accidentally drives the car instead off of the road and into a ditch, to which Bang Bang and Stephen then change their Olympic scores.
To higher scores.
7.9.
Yeah, it's a hilarious scene because he flat out nails it perfectly. He flies.
He doesn't die.
Rolls, and then Penelope's car stops, and you're like, oh, she's going to get out now.
She's trying to do a three-point turn.
Trying to do a three-point turn on a two-lane road, but she's so much of a moron, she just wrecks another Lambo.
Cut to Penelope's hospital bed. Bloom drives her home since they've taken her car, and they awkwardly get to know each other. Penelope is really bad at talking to people, but she has several hobbies that she's pretty good at. Lots of musical instruments, karate, skateboarding, breakdancing, pinhole camera photography, and juggling chainsaws, to name a few.
My favorite of her hobbies is the juggling, because we start with different levels of juggling.
Right.
And we go from like regular juggling to like juggling chainsaws. Then, in the room, and then the next scene is her on a, not just a unicycle.
It's like a heightened unicycle.
It's like a 10-foot unicycle, and she's like, just throw it!
She's like, okay, like, you're gonna just, he's like, I don't feel comfortable. No, you're just gonna throw me the chainsaw.
Just throw it!
So they spend the afternoon together and start to like each other before Bloom has to leave. And he tells her that he's gonna be taking a steamer the next day at noon with his brother because they're antiques dealers. Cut to the docks the next day, and Bloom tells Stephen that he doesn't think she's coming. He needs another day to hook her. And then we see a Lambo Tokyo drifting past him in the background and crashing to a stop. Penelope has joined them, after all. And then when she gets there, she's like, oh, where's this boat going? Penelope and Bloom get to know each other a little bit better, and we find out that her childhood was pretty lonely.
Her childhood is so lonely because she's just allergic to something. And so they do the sticker test to check for all these different allergies, and she's allergic to everything. Mm-hmm. Later on, they realize she wasn't allergic to any of those things. She was allergic to the aluminum.
In the needles.
In the needles. So
she spent her childhood sealed up in her house by herself.
For no reason.
For no reason. This is very sad.
Very sad.
That's why she has all those hobbies.
Mm-hmm. She makes a point of how horrible her childhood was, but she decided that she was going to write her own story, that it wasn't going to be a story of tragedy and loss. It was going to be, she was going to be a girl who would love everyone, even those who wronged her. And Bloom is just completely falling in love with her as she's explaining all this.
Yeah, because he asks her if she's ever felt cheated, and she said the only way to not feel cheated is to cheat. And so she cheats by...
by writing her own story, even though...
she's flipping the script, which, foreshadowing! So while they're on the ship, she has a weird encounter with this Frenchman who tells her that the brothers Bloom are not actually antiques dealers, but the world's best antique smugglers. His name is Melville, and he is a curator at the National Musée in Prague. And Penelope is no dumb bunny. She picks up on the fact that his name is Melville, and that the ship that they're on is called the Fidel, which is the name of the ship in one of Melville's novels, The Confidence Man, to which Stephen is like, huh, never read that one.
Well, you can see he is puckering. He is like, everyone's like, oh my gosh, you figured it out.
Everyone's looking at him like, retcons like a Russian novelist. So Penelope is enchanted by the idea that the brothers are actually smugglers. In a conversation while they're bearing their souls to each other, Bloom tells Penelope that he thinks Stephen would actually love to die on a job. His dream is to tell a story so well that it fulfills itself. Stephen sees that they're getting close, and he reminds Bloom the only danger is if he falls in love with the girl, because he keeps wanting to back out. As he says this, you're kind of getting the feeling that he's almost daring Bloom to fall in love with the girl, because it's all part of the plan.
Clearly. Clear reverse psychology.
So they land in Greece, and Melville tells Penelope about a proposition. If they give him $1 million, he will steal a rare book and give it to them so that they can sell it for $2.5 million. So she's super intrigued by being a smuggler, and she wants in on the adventure, and she thinks it's going to be fun, and she tries to convince them. She says, if you three want to join my
smuggling ring, just let me know.
I mean, I'll consider it. So they board a train, and she warms up by stealing snacks from the snack car. She's also workshopping nicknames. Bloom is just in a bad mood, and he won't give her a smuggler nickname. She tells him that he's just upset because he's constipated in the soul, and he has a grumpy, petrified poo in his soul. She tries to throw herself at him, but he quickly extricates himself from the car and runs away. So they pull into Prague and proceed with the heist. Penelope has fronted $1 million of her own dollars for the deal. She and Bloom are getting closer, and Bloom runs into a weird old guy named Diamond Dog with an eye patch. Is this like a Boondock Saints scenario?
This movie continuously is somewhere between reality and...
And Boondock Saints?
Kind of. It's somewhere between reality and imagination. Like, Boondock Saints is just like this weird world that was clearly written by a 14-year-old boy experiencing testosterone and puberty for the first time. It's a very whimsical movie.
It's very Wes Anderson.
In a way.
So Diamond Dog, surprise, surprise, taught the boys everything they know, and he loved them. But he says ominously that one day Stephen will fall, and he won't be there to protect Bloom or to tell him what to do. And what will he do then? So Stephen shows up, smashes a wine bottle, and he cuts Diamond Dog in the hand. So they end up being seemingly double-crossed by Melville, who's disappeared with the money.
Which is really funny because the con is Melville just ran away with the money.
But they're too early.
And so Stephen, like, where did he go? And they opens up like a closet.
And he's in the closet. He's like, aren't you a little bit too early?
And Stephen just keeps going with the bit. But Penelope does not see.
And Penelope, though, is still determined to finish the job. So the boys come up with a scheme using Bang Bang's explosives to create a diversion so Penelope can sneak into the Prague castle and steal the book, which, unbeknownst to her, is actually a fake. So the night before the heist, Bloom and Penelope make out awkwardly because it seems like Penelope does everything awkwardly.
I think it was supposed to be that this was her first kiss. And so they have a cute little peck. And then Bloom just opens his mouth a little bit. And she's like, whoa!
And she keeps moaning weirdly.
She's acting like this is the first time she's been tongue-kissed. And so she's simultaneously...
tongue-kissed.
So she's acting like this is the first time she's been French-kissed. And so she's like simultaneously aroused yet...
And disgusted.
Disgusted by tongue-kissing.
Okay, stop. So the next day, there's a mix-up with the explosion. It was supposed to be tiny enough to set off the fire drill, but instead it blows up an entire tower of the castle and sets off a national emergency.
So Penelope is walking towards the building when this explosion happens, and everyone obviously is like running from the building, and the brothers are like, abort, abort, and she looks and just decides to go into the building.
So they lock up the gates just as the police cars and the National Guard helicopter start swarming the scene. And the three are frozen in unbelief as they hope that the authorities will just shoo Penelope away, as long as she doesn't do anything suspicious. Cut to Penelope crawling through the air ducts with the book hanging out of her mouth by a plastic bag. And the air duct gives away and she tumbles out in front of a crowd of police and then is detained. So somehow she's able to talk her way out of the chief of police's car.
Which I both simultaneously hate, yet love, that we have no idea what she says to the police inspector that allows her to leave with the book.
So Bloom is blown away by her, and I guess he wants to feel alive like she did. And so on a walk, he steals an apple from a fruit vendor and gets caught. All to the soundtrack of Cat Stevens' Miles from Nowhere, which made me want to go dig up my cassette of Cat Stevens from high school and listen to Tea for the Tillerman, How Can I Tell You, and Wild World.
Wild World is a good song.
Did you like Cat Stevens in high school?
You did Cat's Cradle, right?
Okay, that's the... Keith likes the Billboard top 10 songs that
people actually like and pay money for, whereas Corey likes the obscure catalog. Like, oh, what? Well, it's half finished, but whatever. It's real art.
So they sail to Mexico, which Steve isn't thrilled about because he doesn't want to simplistically vilify an entire country, but Mexico is a horrible place. And I was, God, that's so much sailing. Like, they're sailing on the yacht, Greece to Mexico? What are we, pilgrims on the Mayflower?
It's
a lot of sailing.
You know, it takes money to make money. And so the amount of money they're spending on this con is just astronomical.
That's the other thing I was thinking. It's like, who's footing the bill? Anyway, so they're in Mexico.
To meet with the Argentinian who's going to buy the book.
To meet up with a fake person. So they totally didn't have to go to Mexico. But anyway. So the night before, Penelope tells Bloom that she's really happy, which makes Bloom sad because he's fallen in love with her. So he confesses to her that the brothers are actually con men and this whole thing is a scam. So they decide to run away together. But first, Bloom wants to go grab the money from Steven's room. Penelope doesn't want the money, but Bloom breaks into Steven's room anyway to find Steven waiting for them in the dark. And they try to turn the light on, and Steven's like, "You have to turn it on from the base." So the brothers physically fight, and a gun goes off, and it appears that Steven is wounded, but Penelope sees right through it. Walks over, and Steven thinks that she's trying to, like, care for him, but really she reaches into his shirt and grabs the blood pack that's in his shirt, and then they all know that they're caught, and so she leaves because she's disappointed. So cut to 3 months later, everyone is on their own, Bang Bang is singing karaoke in Tokyo, Penelope has returned to New Jersey, she blows up her mansion with the skills that she learned from Bang Bang. And she goes to find Bloom, who's back in Montenegro, drinking. Just like he said he would be. She's had a long time to think about it, and she wants to become Penelope the con artiste. Bloom tells her to go away, and he tries to convince her that she was just a mark, and nothing between them was real, but she doesn't believe him. Bloom angrily sends for Steven, and accuses him of knowing that Penelope would come back. And he has Steven set up a con for her with her last $1.75 million in a way that she will never be involved with him again because he loves her. The plan will unfold in St. Petersburg. The first million that Penelope's already given them is gone already. All three of us already split it already. They have to sell the book that they stole on the last job, and it will end with the team faking their own deaths as they are double-crossed after the exchange and killed in a moonlight hail of gunfire. Bloom is incensed when he discovers that Steven has roped Diamond Dog into the operation, but Steven assures him that they can't end this thing without him, and he promises it's all going to be okay. So the next day, on the way to the exchange, the group is ambushed by Russian mobsters, and Steven is taken, and Bang Bang quits. So she gets in her car, and it blows up. And we don't know if that's for real or not. And they find a ransom note for $1.75 million, which makes Bloom very suspicious. So Penelope wires the money anyway, and they head off to go get Steven from the kidnappers. And we find Steven. He's all beat up, and he's in the custody of some mobsters. And a phone call from Diamond Dog confirms that he has double-crossed the boys. And he says that he warned him that Steven would fall one day, and Bloom would be paralyzed. So Bloom reacts. He shoots at the mobsters, and they shoot back, and Steven jumps in front of Bloom, saving his life. And the mobsters run away, leaving a bleeding Steven on the floor. And he tells Bloom, not to worry, it's just a con. And he, like, does a backflip, and that he'll see him later. He says, can I have a wow for this? Because that's all he wanted, was a wow.
Mm-hmm.
Also tells Bloom that he's the only audience he's ever needed. Mm-hmm. So Bloom takes off with Penelope, and on the ride, he looks down at his shirt, and he notices that the blood on his shirt has turned brown. And then he knows that means that Steven was actually shot and wounded and is now probably dead. Steven dies in a chair alone with a card up his sleeve, seemingly very pleased with himself. because he died in his own con.
Probably for real, but it's a con man movie, so who knows if he actually dies or not.
So Penelope tells Bloom that she loves him, and then they're going to live like they're telling the best story in the whole world. Because as Steven has said before, the perfect con is one in which each one involved gets just the thing that they wanted. And that's the end of the movie. I think the whole thing was set up by Steven. I think that Bloom did a good job foreshadowing this in the beginning when he told Penelope that Steven probably wanted to die in one of his stories. And the fact that Steven says that the day that comes when he cons Bloom is the day he dies.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, hello! I think this whole thing was an elaborate setup that he orchestrated, and his death is part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, that would be his greatest achievement, would be able to con his brother, which he does. The only real part of the con is at the very end. Steven convinces his brother that it's not real, that it is a con. So,
yeah, I thought it was interesting that there were a lot of unintentional parallels in both movies. Both about sibling relationships. They're both about baggage. They are both about ridiculously rich bored people with issues. They both take place partly on a train. And Adrian Brody was actually filming the Darjeeling Limited when he read this script and he wanted to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Weiss actually had to learn all of the hobbies that she was doing so she could be passable enough in the scenes. Brody taught her how to skateboard in a parking lot in between takes. Also, he taught her how to rap.
Which didn't make the cut, so you can tell how good it went.
So what did I think? I'm not typically a fan of con man films. They're usually like super involved, and I have to watch it more than once to understand everything that's going on. And I did actually have to go back and watch the entire thing again. Because it's like everybody in the movie's conning each other, but then also like they're conning you. So yeah. I think that the ending's pretty open and that probably people all take their own interpretations of what happened and what's real. There are some fun moments, like when the camel drinks the flask, whenever Penelope is driving. I love Steven's sense of humor or anything that Bang Bang does. Bang Bang's amazing. She's my favorite character in this movie by far. Roger Ebert said about this film that acting was a delight, but that the script was too smug and pleased with itself. Which I could see that.
I think it was a good script.
It was very clever.
I felt like the script needed one or two more passes. The problem with a lot of con artist movies is they have so many cons going by the end. It's just like they have to be written in a way where it makes sense why the characters would do what they want. There's a couple moments like the end. It's like, did Steven really write his own death? Would he really want to do that?
Maybe he just didn't want to do conning without his brother anymore. And so he was like, well, if he's going to leave, then I'm going to give up. And what else do I have? So might as well go out with a bang.
Yeah, I just didn't see that moroseness in Steven's character. I saw it in Adrian Brody's character, Bloom.
Yeah.
I mean, Bloom is way too brooding the whole time. I thought it was good, but I didn't think it was like a double thumbs up like I thought when I suggested we see the movie.
So would you like to know what I thought about the movie?
Yes.
So overall, I feel like the performances were delightful and it was a good ensemble film. I mean, it's not my type of movie, but, you know, I felt like it was well written. I felt like the performance was really great. It was a little smug, but I mean, you know, I felt like he tied up all the loose ends and also give you kind of like a mystery at the, like, open-ended, like, like, did he really die or did he really mean to? Like, it's enough of an intrigue where I thought about it afterwards quite a bit. I'm like, what?
So how many hats would you give this one? Is this a two-hat movie or a one-hat movie?
I give this a 1.5 hat.
All right.
I liked it.
Yeah?
I probably won't ever watch it again.
Hey, if you want to join my smuggling ring, why don't you just let me know?
I'll consider it. Okay.
We did it.
We certainly did.
I thought that was a little harsh on the Darjeeling Limited.
What?
A little, but... Still not my favorite movie, but I realized, especially after watching The Brothers Bloom, I was like, I was probably a little too harsh.
Oh, because they're kind of similar?
They are, and I didn't realize it.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
I am willing to say when I'm wrong. Like, as a teacher especially, some teachers are so paranoid, I can never be wrong, and I'm like, you know, you're going to be wrong sometimes, so, you know.
Oh, I'm wrong all the time, and I tell our child, I'm sorry, I was wrong.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. The wrong thing is when you don't admit when you're being wrong. So what are we going to watch next?
Well, I think we both need a palate cleanser.
We do. This has been a couple times in a row when we've both been kind of like, oh, yeah.
I just really want to watch a movie that I like. And I think you'll like this movie because you're very women's rights. And I don't want to say you're like a feminist because...
No,
What should I say?
No, I honestly have no problem with that term. I'm for equal rights.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that if you watch this, then you'll be able to, speak the lingo with your students. I don't know. I just really want to watch it again. And I asked for it for Christmas. I didn't know if I should take our child to go see it or not because, she's nine. Mm-hmm. And so one of my friends who I work with took her fifth grader. And she said, yeah, there's some innuendo, but it'll go over her head. And I think that the message is good. So we went and saw it. And I loved it. She liked it when we got out of the theater and we were driving home. She was like, I get it. Ken is treated in the Barbie world how women are often treated in the real world.
Aw, our daughter is so smart.
And there's a famous monologue that no one will ever be able to do because it's like the Sally Field monologue from Steel Magnolias. No one will ever be able to do that.
Is this the level of like the Phoebe Cates Gremlins monologue of Santa
Claus?
Oh God,
no. It is the absolute opposite of that. Okay.
So of course what I'm going to watch is Barbie. So
you're watching the Barbie movie.
I get to watch the Barbie movie.
Which I think you're really going to enjoy, Ken. I'm going to say something controversial. I don't really care about Ryan Gosling like everybody else does. But this movie changed my mind.
Really?
And he was my favorite. It's funny, our child asked for the Barbie dream house for Christmas.
Oh, God, she did, yes.
And we have a Frozen house. Frozen castle. That is about as big as our house that mm-hmm. my mother got for her for $10 off Craigslist. Mm-hmm. And when my mother showed it to me.
Did not clear it with us before she had done it.
Did not clear it with us. When she showed it to me, I cried because, mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to. I'm a slumlord now. I have to take rent for it because mm-hmm. it's so big.
Yeah, but fortunately our friend was willing to take it off our hands for one of her best friends, and those little girls love it. Mm-hmm. And I got to put together a 150-piece
Barbie
dream house, which is three stories. And
bigger than and the Frozen Castle.
Water slide.
And double-sided.
And you know what? And the smile on her daughter's face is completely worth it. So she loves that, and I love her, so.
I don't know where to put it.
Yeah.
I thought, I'm going to finally get rid of this monstrosity, and we're going to trade it for something smaller.
Mm-hmm. and we got something with its own time zone, so.
So, yes, you're mm-hmm. going to watch Barbie.
I'm going to watch Barbie. And then I have been chomping at the bit to get back to Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. Because we only have about 26 more left to go. And so, to catch up. So, next up on the list is one of the best reviewed of the Marvel movies. This one is called Civil War. It's basically Captain America 3, Civil War.
Okay.
So, it's not my favorite, but it is one of my favorites. And it has everybody in the Marvel universe basically up to that point.
The gang's all back together.
Yeah, except for Hulk and Thor, which I could go into why they're not there.
It's
but,
okay. You don't have to explain okay. right now.
So
I'm sure you'll do it later. Is the Wonder Woman plane going to be the kitty?
I'm trying to remember if the Hello Kitty
Carrier, is that going to make an appearance?
I don't remember. Should I have shown Thor Ragnarok before this or not? But I think it's fine. I think we'll just go with Civil War.
And it's
I
not think, like I'm going to understand the ins and outs of either of those movies anyways.
Yeah, I guess technically we should be doing Thor Ragnarok, but wow, your eyes are rolling. So we'll see. We'll be watching Civil War or Thor Ragnarok. Stay tuned to find out.
Well, it's not like, we change our minds ever.
No, never. But thank you for never changing your mind and always listening to us. You can always go to our Facebook page or
our Instagram page.
He saw, she saw. And give us likes, reviews.
Yes, go on Apple Podcasts and give us a review and rate us.
Mm-hmm.
Follow us or whatever.
We don't know. We're old.
I do all the marketing, so.
You're amazing.
Our He Saw, She Saw podcast Gmail is full.
How is it full?
Because I connected it to my phone's photo album and it's full. So now I have two Google Photos that are full.
Nice.
That's how many pictures I take.
On that note, anyway. We hope you guys had a wonderful 2023.
And we hope you have a wonderful 2024.
And we will chat at you later.
Bye.
Tea, oh the tea, oh the tea, oh the tea, oh the sweet tasty tea. Let's have some tea at the tea party that starts at 3.
The Darjeeling tea.
No.
Oh, can you sing about the Darjeeling tea?
I don't think I can say it right.